the original calculations for which I'm reporting are basically re-emphasizing earlier results. With this one, we put out in 2009, published 2010, and then there is a subsequent work that I'll go into it, and you're encouraged to ask questions. I feel very confident with this pointing stick, so please go ahead and try me. And the title, I think, basically gives my picture. So the scope is this new measurement of the positron flux in interstellar space by the AMS-2 mission. AMS-2 is a real particle detector that's mounted on the International Space Station since May 11. And it reinforced and improved earlier measurements by the PAMELA satellite of the flux of high-energy positrons. So energies of order 100 GeV outside of the Earth atmosphere. And are there astrophysicists here in the audience? In general, this is, so the main thing you need to understand when you try to to calculate this thing, so the flux of these high energy cosmic rays outside of the Earth atmosphere, is basically what are the astrophysical sources for these particles. We do understand the production of some of these cosmic rays, at least positrons count as one species that we understand relatively well what's going on with. Please do stop me, ask questions on anything that goes over your head just because it's an astrophysical term, because it's all very, very simple. There's no reason to not understand everything, every single point of that I'll be trying to make. So just go ahead and ask questions if anything is confusing. So what really we're talking about? We're talking about a new measurement of antimatter in space, relativistic energies. Why are we doing this? So besides from the interesting astrophysics, and there are important questions in astrophysics that are related to these measurements, we really want to find some hints for fundamental physics out there, for instance, dark matter. And the distributions of antimatter in astrophysical environments. So first, there is very little antimatter, of course. So there is no primordial antimatter, essentially. This is the famous baryon asymmetry that we're aware of. The only antimatter that exists comes in nature's collider experiments or fixed target experiments. So nature does seem to have some accelerators of her own. They are high-energy particles. They collide with other particles. That's produced a lot of stuff, and including antimatter, just as it is formed in our experiments. But this is high energy. We're going to go up to the weak scale. And for instance, annihilation of dark matter could also contribute to something like that. Any Charles symmetric annihilation process would give you some similar amount of antimatter and matter. And so there could be other sources out there. And this is why really we're doing that. And as you know, the AMS measurement, the first result they put out is for the positron flux. And there is a curious trend with energy of the measurement that I'm going to explain. So, and really the focus of my talk would be beyond speculations and beyond the fact that we really want to find dark matter or anything exotic out there, what do we really learn from these measurements? What do we robustly learn and understand from this data? How can we improve what we know? And that's a picture of AMS sitting, that's a detector here, sitting on the International Space Station since May of 2011. To set the stage, the big excitement about this positron measurement started or restarted with the results of the PAMELA satellite in 2008, actually, published in Nature, among other places. And that was the first reliable measurement of antimatter, positrons, and antiproton at relativistic energies, 100 GeV or so, outside of the Earth atmosphere. And this is the plot. This is the result for the measurement of the positron flux. What they're actually reporting, and you're going to see this plot and other similars to that throughout the talk, what they're plotting here is the ratio of the flux of positrons, okay, at energies of as a function of energy, so the ratio of the flux of positrons to the total flux of electrons and positrons at the same energy, okay? And they give this variable, this observable, so the ratio of fluxes, because it's cleaner from the experimental perspective. I will argue, and we can discuss this further, that for the theoretical interpretation, this variable is not actually very suitable because it involves different uncertainties. Just a plain good measurement of the positron flux would be much more informative as a discriminant, for instance, between astrophysical production and exotic physics. But this is what they can measure best, and this is what they reported. So just the flux of positrons to the total flux, to the total electronic flux. And as they said, there is a rise in this positron fraction with energy. This black line is a sample result from some popular propagation model, so some model that describes, that tries to calculate and predict the fluxes of different cosmic ray particles. And this rise in intention with the prediction of many of these models that were out there in the literature, and that's the beginning of this big excitement.
Sir,
yeah.
What is black dots are
these black dots?
No, the left side.
This
yeah,
here.
What's that? Though?
What's this?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is the results from which one is this? Some theoretical propagation model. You're asking, why is the model very far from the points here? Why is it very far from the points here?
Yeah, I mean, you have some data on the left side.
Yeah, so you're saying about, you're asking about the experimental data.
Yeah,
why are the points here?
At the given energy, you have some formula.
Yeah.
That is very lower than what you have.
Compared to that. Great. So these the energies where you see this phenomena is are relatively low, so below about 10 GeV. What you should understand is below 10 GeV nuclei, like protons and boron, that are used to calibrate these models, right? They begin to become non-relativistic, and then you can have very complicated propagation effects, for instance, in the solar neighborhood. So the energy, for instance, the energy spectrum of protons and electrons and all of these cosmic rays can be significantly different in interstellar space than in our solar neighborhood below about 10 GeV. 10 GeV is roughly the characteristic transition where you begin. So above 10 GeV, you begin not to care about this local phenomena. So this is propagation in the solar wind, can change its points also as a function of time. Here, by the way, this is very curious because the thing that supposedly, so imagine this is solar modulation. It's a very curious and complicated plasma physics effect because what this thing is supposed to be doing is differentiate between the charges. So you should have all of this effect, supposedly a time-dependent effect, okay, for the propagation. These points, when they were measured, the condition for the plasma propagation in the solar system were supposedly different than in here, but they should be different for positrons than for electrons. Otherwise, this thing shouldn't have responded. So difficult to calculate, can very well be either an experimental error or very likely just low energy complications from the solar neighborhood. It can be time-dependent. So the reason that you may not feel there is a very good answer to your question is because I don't know of a very good answer, but this is the ballpark. So I can say safely, you can easily expect order one modifications to the spectrum because of time-dependent phenomena in the solar neighborhood, okay, that are very difficult to calculate. In all of my talk, actually, after following this slide, I'm only going to focus on the very relativistic region for both nuclei and leptons. Okay, so basically I'm going to cut it at 10 GeV, and where you can estimate what's the effect on solar modulation, you can actually measure also the effect of solar modulation from nuclei and show that it's not important above at a very relativistic energy. So because I don't understand what's going on here, and it's much more difficult to calculate, I will just focus on the very relativistic region. Thanks.
I guess you had access to the full paper.
Yes, eventually I had access.
Okay.
Yeah, but this was done at my dad's home. So. All right. So, and back then in 2009, we did some analysis of this in this paper here, and that rise of the positron fraction with energy again spawned many analyses saying that it has to be some primary source like pulsars or dark matter annihilation. I'll explain what primary source mean. But some exotic mechanism. We did an analysis that I will explain here, and we calculated the only robust prediction that we are aware of for what this quantity E plus over E plus minus can be under the most standard mundane assumptions for the astrophysical mechanism of the production of these guys, and I'll explain what I'm talking about. And this is the Pamela data from back then. And as you can see, throughout the energy range, it's below this upper bound. So this curve, the green curve, is an upper bound for this standard mechanism. It's model independent. It's purely data driven. There are no free parameters in calculating this bound. And the measurement is below this upper bound throughout the range. So we conclude that this could be easily secondary production. So just standard, no reason for a primary source. Typical models in the literature, however, that came after that. So remember that the popular diffusion models predict for you a line that falls like somewhere like this in this range. So there are many suggestions to add alternative sources like dark matter annihilation or pulsars, characterized typically by the following fact. So this is the positron to electron plus positron ratio. Dynamically, it's bounded by 0.5 or so. Okay, it can be much larger than 0.5 in charge-conserving models. So all of these models would rise to the natural scale, few tens of percent, and then typically fall with a sharp cutoff, though this is very hard to calculate or predict in any model. But that this should give you a ballpark for how this explanation looked like. Then we had more data slowly, so still to get the perspective. This is a subsequent Pamela measurement with error bar that's about half as large than the previous measurement. And I'm showing it just so you keep in mind these measurements are very difficult. There is a large background to the measurement of the positron flux. And there can easily be, and we know that there are systematic errors in many of these experiments. You have to be careful when you analyze that. Usually, really just fitting some theory curve smack to the data is bound to exclude your model eventually. This is the Fermi measurement that came out, a beautiful measurement by the Fermi satellite. Also tried to measure this fraction. Was never really consistent with the Pamela measurement systematically, okay? And we can talk about that. It's a beautiful measurement. And now we have AMS 2 here, which is why I'm giving this talk. And it was a big experimental step and an improvement of this measurement. And this is what it gave, all right? So this is the latest data that we have. This can summarize my talk before I get into the details. So there was no reason to think initially, and most of the models in the literature wouldn't predict that this upper bound would be respected. This fraction seems to be shooting up, no sign of slowing down. And that's the new measurement, which is completely consistent with this upper bound calculation. All right, so that this is... I wouldn't do it now, but the moment, so do people do that? So people did it for Attic, for instance. I could show you the Attic measurement, which is completely systematically inconsistent with that. So AMS, I just had a correspondence with some of these guys at AMS. They're going to be alive for of order 10 years, I think, from now. And they're going to improve this measurement by a lot. Both systematics will be understood better and statistics. If, when the error bar shrinks more, you still have these little wiggles, then they're very interesting to try to understand, especially to correlate these wiggles with other curves. But as it is now, I wouldn't attribute anything, not even to the precise. So this, by me, there can easily still be some systematic uncertainty up or down on this curve. If I would put the Fermi measurement before, it sits somewhere here. So these experiments, you have to take them with a grain of salt. And really also important, you have to try to combine. If you're combining different data sets, you want to do it from the same experiment. Normalization is very difficult always. And something like these little wiggles, I would wait for it. But it's very interesting.
Did you already mention where those upper bounds come from?
No, this is the thing I will explain. And this is the thing that I think is worth of a long discussion. So, and to summarize what I will say in the next about these primary models, the fact that pulsars obviously continue to exist after this measurement, and plausibly also dark matter, shows to you that these games of fitting the spectra directly with a model with many free parameters, they are dangerous. It's a dangerous opportunity to lose a lot of your time. And the fact that the positron fraction went down doesn't tell us in any way that pulsars don't exist anymore. They are there. We just don't know to calculate what is the positron flux expected from a pulsar. What this?
Yeah, I'm
here. Yeah. So the green, what I'm doing here, The only thing I can calculate really, and I'm going to explain how, is the positron is an upper bound on the positron flux. I have nothing to say whatsoever on the electron flux. Electrons are primary, and so it's a whole different story. So what I'm doing, I'm calculating the upper bound on the positron flux, and then I normalize this by the measured electron and positron flux. So the width of the green beans reflects, so the data I use is Fermi for this. And it would change a little bit if I take Attic, for instance, or something else. We want to really do it with AMS data. But the width is just the Fermi experimental errors on this flux. And the width of this of the paler green is my estimate of the uncertainties from various sources we can discuss, mostly from the production cross-section, but also from other sources that I can
explain. All right, so actually, the fact that the green is small, that green is small, that's the direction that goes, is that actually you're not limited by the Fermi uncertainty in the flux.
Unless there is some, yeah. Not by the quartet uncertainties, at least. But again, if I would put Attic on this, the size of the quartet uncertainties by Attic on the total flux is not really larger than the Fermi,
right.
But it's just inconsistent. So you should look at the broad picture of that, okay? And I think also these systematic uncertainties for the normalization, this is roughly included in this paler green. So this paler green, which is much larger, unfortunately, give you a picture of what really you can say. So what do we really learn from this? And how do we understand these measurements? What are the lessons? So for this, I need to give you a lightning review of what these cosmic rays are, what we know about them, what we don't know about them. I'll do it in a very few slides. Do ask questions on anything that you want. These are the crucial slides. Understanding this, you will be able to understand this green band and understand the implications of this data. So we're talking about galactic cosmic rays. We think, so there is a flux. If you go out of the Earth atmosphere that's protecting us from this, there is an intense flux of highly relativistic particles, proton, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, antiprotons, positrons, electrons, everything you want. There is a cloud of these things outside. They're believed to be galactic of origin, so they're supposedly trapped in the galaxy for a long time and probably produced inside of our galaxy somewhere. And at least up to very, very high energy, so 10 to the 15 electron volt or so, and potentially much higher. So hugely high energies out there. The energy density in this relativistic gas is not negligible. So it's of order an electron volt per centimeter cubed out there in interstellar space. And this is unfortunately comparable to basically anything else that we see in the galaxy. So it's comparable to the kinetic energy density in gas. It's comparable even to the CMB. It's comparable to what we think we know about magnetic fields. And it's comparable to radiation field from stars. All of these ingredients, this is roughly the pool of kinetic energy in our galaxy, they all have comparable energy densities. So it's not a negligible component. And it could be a driver for the structure of the galaxy, for instance. It could be a main source of pressure. The flux of these particles is roughly can be sorted out into two populations. One I call primaries, and the other I call secondaries. The primary particles include, for instance, proton, carbon, and iron. And they have somewhat higher flux than for the other populations. And the ratio, so the ratio of hydrogen to carbon or carbon to iron in this population of cosmic rays is similar to what we see near the sun, just in ambient gas. What we learned from this is that the picture, there is a consistent picture for where these primaries are coming from. They should be coming from material that was processed in stars to give you similar elemental abundances, and then somehow accelerated.
Is there a reason you don't include helium?
No, helium is included. Yeah, helium is a primary. Absolutely. No reason. There is a long list of this stuff. So consistent with stellar material, accelerated somehow, probably by some sort of Fermi mechanism. We don't actually need to go into the details or understand where this population is coming from, and that's good because it's not known where this primary density is coming, energy density is coming from. All you need to know for my talk is just the fact that this population exists out there. It will serve as a beam for us. So we measure this beam of proton, helium, carbon, and iron. The other thing that we see outside there is gas, just interstellar hydrogen, some helium, and also some heavier elements, just scattered, not accelerated in the medium. And given that we measure this high energy beam of particles, it inevitably collides with the target. The collision with the targets produces for you a shower of secondaries. So if you have a 100 GeV proton colliding with some ambient gas hydrogen, it will give to you antiprotons, for instance, and many other particles, pions or also leptons eventually, at the 10 GeV range. All right, so you inevitably have these collisions. And indeed, there is a secondary population of cosmic rays, such as boron, beryllium, and much heavier elements, and also antiprotons and positrons that we see. And the relative densities of the fluxes of these is consistent with taking this primary beam and smashing it into the gas. All right? So the source is there. We know. We see the target. We see the beam. There is a yield. We measure. The yield is consistent with this picture. Okay? This by itself is not a trivial observation. We do actually learn something from that. And important part is really to analyze the implication or to understand, try to understand theoretically the secondary population. We don't necessarily need to know why and so what put these primaries out there in the first place. It's enough for us to know that there is a beam and there is a target.
How do we know that some of these ran into the primaries?
That some of what?
The ones that are the secondaries.
Some of the secondaries. Yeah. So many of the secondaries, like boron, are very, very inefficiently produced in stellar environments. Mm-hmm. So to produce them, to produce them really, you need some high-energy collision and then have them remain in there. You don't produce them in steady-state environment in stellar models. That's one. And the second thing.
Boron is produced in stars at all.
Yeah.
It's only produced in the cosmic rays.
Yes.
Or
So similarly, antiprotons. To produce an antiproton, you need energy that you're far from having in a star, for instance, as opposed to the, just the small binding energy of boron. So
one also should say that the abundance of lithium, beryllium, boron in cosmic rays is like orders of magnitude
above. Very good.
The solar
abundance. So exactly. So if you do the following exercise, if you take If you take the abundance, that's really the main argument. If you take the abundance of proton to carbon, for instance, this is to an order of magnitude consistent with what we see in the solar neighborhood with ambient gas. If you now take the abundance of boron to carbon, this is orders of magnitude larger than you will see near the sun, but fully consistent with the picture of secondary production, as I will show to you. All right? I need to show you this, and this I can show you. It's a relatively easy thing to understand. And antimatter in this picture arises as secondary. So just like we understand the boron in terms of spallation of carbon and hydrogen, just the carbon nucleus comes in, hits a hydrogen, something splits off, some nucleon splits off, and you end up with the boron, there must inevitably also production of antimatter, like in this chain, that gives to you positrons, and similarly for antiprotons. What do we not know in this picture? We do not understand the propagation. There are many models for this, but it's a very complicated plasma physics that is not solved. So we don't know what determines the distributions of all of these particles in the galaxy. Okay, and we don't know the primary sources, as I said. We don't really know what put these cosmic rays there in the first place. Now, there are many stories. It could be supernova. It could be acceleration in shock. We know that there are shock fronts in the ISM. So there are environments that could accelerate high-energy particles. We actually know that they accelerate particles. It's not clear for many of these shocks which particles do they actually accelerate. Is it protons or electrons? We don't know if and how the particles escape from these shock environments. So there are many models for that. The broad picture is that probably these guys are coming from supernova remnant shells. It's not obvious. And which type of SNRs, where, when, and how these cosmic rays are coming from, this is not a solved problem. And that's just a picture, a map of polarization gradient in the interstellar matter. And so this is basically a snapshot of the interstellar matter. And the interstellar matter is a highly turbulent medium. The structure that you're seeing is magnetic field structure, so fluctuation in the magnetic field and the electron density. It's a very complicated, far from steady state locally medium. And solving this problem is very difficult. And on top of all of these difficulties, even if the plasma problem is not difficult as it is, again, the energy densities in all of these components is comparable to the energy density in the primary cosmic rays. So it's not even a test particle approximation that can be applied here, probably. So these are unsolved problems. Yeah. Yes.
What was the distance of these structures?
What's the distance? So I don't know. We can go and look into that a little more. But the scale of these things is of order a parsec or a little smaller from what I estimated. So I mean, probably you're talking about hundreds of parsec away or some kiloparsec away. This is in our galaxy. Okay.
Do you mean that the structures should be, so if it's, this is,
you can see far below a degree here.
So.
So the numbers here are degrees.
Yes.
So this is 1 degree. So this is fairly small scale objects, smaller than a parsec, which is good. Yeah, some of these are smaller than parsecs. This is a beautiful new measurement.
The size of stars are smaller than a parsec.
The size of the structure, of the smaller structures. But to just to put you in the pictures, the Larmor radius of the positrons at around the 10 GeV is of order an AU. Okay, so 10 to the 13. So we're talking about 10 to the minus 5 orders of magnitude. So about 5 orders of magnitude below the smallest structure that you're probing directly. So the particles are scrambled on much, much smaller scale than what you're actually measuring. But again, there is a lot to study from this. It's not a problem that cannot be solved, I think, eventually. Or it's not that there is no progress, but it's definitely far from solved right now. So what can we do if we don't try to explain at this moment the primary sources? So what put the primary beam in there for the first place? And the propagation. What can I do robustly? And it's beautiful for our cause that the positrons and antiprotons, so this antimatter we're talking about, is within the secondary class. There we can do a lot. Okay? So turns out that there is at relativistic energies far above this, or sufficiently above this high, this 10 GeV per nucleon roughly, the high energy flux of all of these secondary particles, so boron, antiproton, it follows an empirical relation. So here what I write is the flux of some species S. The flux of the species S, it's a function of energy, or magnetic rigidity more precisely, so energy divided by charge. Please stop me if anything is not clear. So the flux as a function of energy is proportional to a product of two quantities. One I call X escape. X is in units of Coulomb density, so mass per centimeter squared. And this object is a function of magnetic rigidity again, or a function of energy, but it doesn't carry a species label. So this function here is a function of energy, but it doesn't care if S is an antiproton or a boron nucleus. And so the product of this with another function that I call Q, Q does care what is the particle you're talking about, but Q is completely calculable. Q is the net local production rate per unit Coulomb density of target. What do I mean by that? If I have some little volume element of interstellar matter, so some gas of ambient hydrogen, and I measure the beam of protons, carbon, and what have you, that's heating that gas, then per unit traversed target, I will produce a certain amount of boron. I will also lose some boron, by the way, because within the primary, the carbon, etc., there's also boron that's coming in. Some of this boron is fragmented and destroyed on the ISM. So what I need to work with is the net source, so the source minus the sink. This is what I called Q. And it's completely calculable, because if I know the density of hydrogen in the disk of the galaxy or in the interstellar matter, okay, and I know, I know the composition of the gas, and I know the composition and spectrum of the primary beam, which I measure, then I can calculate the yield and the loss, okay? So Q is completely calculable up to uncertainties. And what I'm showing here is just the result of applying this calculation. What this calculation means is the following. I can take the flux of boron, for instance, normalized here by the flux of carbon for convenience. And from this function, so if I take boron, I can calculate Q for boron. I measure the flux for the boron. Okay, so the flux is a function of energy, are the data points. And then with this relation, I can fit for the function X. Okay, I use the boron data, which is the best that we have, and I fit for the function X. Now I take X and apply it to the calculation of some other secondary. All right, so for instance, I look at the side iron elements, elements that are produced by fragmentation of an iron nucleus, calculate Q for them, again, from cross sections and the primary flux and target density, take this X that I measured for boron, and get this theory curve. Okay, so now this is the theory curve, the black line, and moving from the black smooth to the dashed is by changing the composition of interstellar matter. Okay, so just playing with helium composition. And this is the data, and you can see that the same very simple expression or the same function X describes very well all of this data. And I could do it to other secondaries. I'm about to do it to other secondaries in a minute. So there is some very simple relation. Even though I don't know exactly what X is, I'll talk about it a little more, there is a universal function, and the rest is directly calculable from what we measure. So we have X, all right? And that's quite powerful. Good. So I will explain to you exactly what X is. But why does it bother you it depends on X? So here is a way that it could depend on X. Oh, no. The ratio of the species is very roughly X. Not exactly, because this mapping is non-linear, right? Q has in it the flux. So Q has in it, for instance, J boron as well, because Q takes out some flux of boron that is lost by fragmentation. But that's not the crucial point, right? The crucial point, if you take the ratio very roughly, what you're seeing here is directly X. Now take this X, apply it to the iron, and you get the same curve. Or you get the consistent result.
So is it clear?
So what these guys are doing is plotting it as a function of energy per nucleon. So the rigidity at relativistic energy, a good point here is that all of these guys have mass number to Z ratio, very close to 2. Okay, not exactly, but very close to 10%. And so the rigidity is just energy per Z. So very roughly, rigidity is just twice this. Okay, but it's within 10%, and it's a source of uncertainty for us, just this fact that A to Z is not exactly 2. If it was exactly 2, the calculation would have been better. So for this calculation, the source from the boron production is smaller. So the main production is by secondaries, but it's not negligible. But it doesn't matter I will explain to you exactly where this X is coming from, but it is consistent with the same mean column density. X is not exactly the mean column density, in fact. X is the column density at any different point at all, wherever the fragmentation happens in the galaxy. So wherever the fragmentation happens, take the local density of boron, carbon, and everything else, secondary and primaries, fragment them on the hydrogen, and then there is some probability that the secondaries from that place will propagate and eventually be detected by us. And X is the average on all the galaxy of this probability. So there is no reason for nonlinearity in there, if you want. But the nonlinearity, to make it short, the nonlinearity disappears the moment I speak about the net source. At any point, and take source minus sinks. I don't need to fragment them again. Okay, we can talk about it later if I manage to mess it up. But let me talk about this just a little more so it's clear, because this is the main tool that we're using. So this statement, so just understand what it means, this statement, okay? It's very simple and general. This statement is equivalent to saying that the densities of fluxes of secondaries type A and B measured locally are equal to the ratio of the local production rates. Okay, maybe this explains the question that you've asked. We could do the same exercise for the iron and the boron, and this will be the statement here, and here X just cancels out if I do everything at the same rigidity. Why is this a very theoretically natural expression? Again, doesn't tell me what X is, but by itself is very natural. This is very natural because what it says is the following. Imagine that you have some volume element of interstellar matter, okay, with some given composition, and that's bombarded by this flux of primaries. then the yield of secondaries A and B will, of course, change in magnitude if I scale up the target density. If there is more target, there will be more yield. Or I scale up or down the primary flux. Okay? So the yield will definitely change, and the ISM is very inhomogeneous in this sense. But as long as the composition is roughly the same of the beam and the target, then the relative yield of A and B at any given point, and this includes both the production and destruction, the relative net yield is going to be the same regardless of the scalings. Okay? And this is what this equation says. Now, what do I do in practice? I have this relative yield that is the same everywhere if the composition is relative is the same to good approximation everywhere. And I'm just summing, and this is source minus sink again, and I'm just summing the contribution of all these different points in the galaxy. But if the relative contribution is the same everywhere, it will also be the same locally after the propagation. One ingredient that is not obvious, but it's guaranteed to be correct here, is that when you carry the particles from some arbitrary source in the galaxy to us, you have propagation to take into account. And propagation could, in principle, distinguish between particles of different types. Okay? So for instance, electrons lose energy, and their trajectory from a given point to us will be different than the trajectory of a proton. But here, what I'm talking about is particles that are not losing energy, and that's a great approximation for nuclei in our galaxy. Okay? And this means, because the propagation is propagation in magnetic field, it means that if I'm comparing things at the same rigidity or Larmor radius, then the trajectories can be very complicated, but trajectories of A and B at the same Larmor radius or rigidity, they will be the same. All right? So the composition, again, is not screwed up by propagation in magnetic fields for arbitrary configuration of magnetic field as long as I work at a given rigidity. What we learn from this, there is a very simple, general, sufficient condition that will give you an equation like that. The condition is that the composition, the relative abundance of particles in the primary, in the beam, and in the target has to be, if this composition is relatively, is to a good approximation, the same wherever the secondaries are coming from to us, then you have to end up with that. I don't need to assume anything detailed about the propagation. So I wrote this more formally, but I'm not going to dwell on this. We can go back for this if you want. Just to emphasize it, I'm looking at the net production rate and what is x in the end that you get under this assumption. X is the sum of the contributions of the productions in all regions and times, okay, in the galaxy that are relevant for us. You don't need steady state. You don't need anything for this. So I sum over the galaxy. I need to scale up the density of target and beam. If the composition is the same everywhere, this scaling is simply given by the scaling of some chosen calibrator, if you want, the proton flux, for instance. All of this is weighted by the probability for particles produced at some point to end their life here, to be detected. Okay? I don't know what this is, but as long as the probability is not... It can be dependent on energy, but as long as energy is not changed during propagation, which is again good for protons, then I will get this function x. And nowhere here do you get the secondary species label s. Okay? So this weighted sum is independent of what particle I'm looking at. I can go back to this in the end if that's confusing, but it's really ratio of local density equals ratio of local net source. This is what we see. Let's apply this to some secondary, okay? As an example, let's apply this to antiprotons. Antiprotons don't lose energy on propagation at relativistic energies. At low energy, below 10 GeV, again, this will be messed up. But above 10 GeV, it's a very safe assumption. What do you need for the computation? So here I have the flux of antiprotons. And for convenience, I divide it by the measured flux of protons, okay? Locally measured. So the proton flux, which is the main primary source for this. So the proton flux, we can measure directly. Okay. Then there is another piece which you need to compute, and that's the fragmentation cross-section. So in proton-proton collisions, what is the yield of antiprotons? Okay. What is the yield of boron? What is the yield of all of these guys? So these measurements are tabulated in accelerator experiments with some uncertainty, but that's what this is. All of this part here is just a cross-section. And the other thing you need to factor out is that x The fact that it's a nonlinear mapping here is because you do have some loss. So antiprotons do get destroyed occasionally by hitting hydrogen in the disk. You can take this into account just directly from the equation. So this thing here is just X calibrated directly from boron to carbon. So here is the antiproton calculation for you. There are no free parameters in these calculations. Everything is measured. Okay? And it only relies on the simple statement that I did before. And that's the data. Okay? So that's the latest PAMELA data from this year, actually. This green, again, I'm calibrating by the measured proton flux with some uncertainty. And I have uncertainty from both X, which is not very well known. In particular, for instance, I have no high-quality data on X above rigidity of about 300 GeV. This is why I put this huge pale green here. But we will have this. So the moment AMS gives us boron to carbon, and it can do this to a few TeV, okay, then all of this will vanish, and we will have a prediction to a few TeV for this thing. And this is the PAMELA data. So this thing works. It actually works too well. I'm a little bit ashamed of this because, again, there is no reason in the world. This makes you stare too hard in this perfect fit, but by me, no reason in the world where the data couldn't be anywhere in this pale band. So don't take it too literally, but it definitely works.
Where does the energy dependence come from
in here?
Yeah.
So the for the antiprotons in particular, the production cross-section has a threshold at around this region of order 10 GeV. You need quite a lot. So it is a proton-proton collision. And in the center of mass, you have to end up with proton-proton. So the leading process is proton-proton plus antiproton-proton. And then there is a rest frame threshold of around 8 GeV to do this. So there is a characteristic bump for antiprotons. It goes down below.
The shape is just comes from that cross-section.
So a number, shape is coming from a number of things. This has a shape. That's this X. I said we measure it. So I may as well give you the value. So this X, at this point, you can think about it just as a number. And it is energy dependent. So this X, to 10% accuracy, is 8.7 times e to z over 10 GeV minus 0.5 gram per centimeter squared. From now on, you don't need to think about it anymore. We have calibrated out with boron to carbon, and it is a function of energy. So the drop, expected drop here, is mainly this.
So is this what you base the measurement on? So you just you compare your formula to these points, and then you from that you measure X?
No. I've measured X from a completely analogous calculation for boron to carbon. So I could write exactly the same formula, except that I write boron here. Here I have the sum of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, which are the main.
Boron, and then you say it's completely consistent with that.
Yeah, so I measure this function. I measure from the boron and carbon flux. Just measure it. Plug it in here. This is accelerator data. And this is the proton flux that I measure. Okay. And this dependence is a mix of energy dependence of cross-section. It's a function of energy and of X. But all completely calculable.
Why does it? The cross-sections for carbon. I
guess it's protons on carbon-carbon. Right? Again, it's carbon on ambient hydrogen. That's the main production for boron.
But presumably the best measurement of that cross-section is carbon-carbon.
Some of this, but some of this there were also beams of heavy nuclei that the people were looking at. So nuclear
data sheet. And that's well measured up to the relevant energy.
Well measured to within the uncertainties I'm quoting. I will not take any of this better than 10% or so. But that's the ballpark.
Okay. But that's not all
of it. At this point, I think the proton-proton cross-section is a more difficult problem. And for these heavier elements, the leading production is very simple. You have just spallation, which means you take something like carbon, smash it onto a hydrogen, and you just chip off a nucleon, and you end up with a boron. So that's the way it's going to happen. These are more under control than the more complicated processes. So why does it work so well? That's an artist's illustration of our galaxy. And it's nothing. It's very far from homogeneous in any way. Why does this calculation actually work that well? It's not obvious at all. Because even the simple assumption that I've made, that the composition is uniform everywhere where the signatories are coming from, is not obvious at all. The composition of the ISM is not uniform in the galaxy. Okay? But it's not too far from uniform, and I think what we're learning from the antiproton and Bohr measurements is just this fact. Even though the galaxy is a complicated object, with grandness and everything you just want to imagine, it appears to be uniform enough in composition where the secondaries are coming from. If we learn anything qualitatively and robust from these measurements, it's that statement. One way by which it could work, if I'm speculating, if we look at some edge-on galaxies, if we look in optical or close to optical, we just see the stars and the gas. And these form, and this is the same in our galaxies, these form a very, very thin disk of scale width or scale height of this disk, orders of magnitude smaller than the scale, the radial scale of the system. Now, if you go and look closer to the radio, you see the synchrotron emission of a cloud of relativistic electrons that are emitting synchrotron radiation and inverse Compton radiation at low energies. And what you're seeing here is just you're illuminating a halo of relativistic electrons that's around the galaxy. And the scale height of this halo in some of the galaxies, we know observationally, is again potentially an order of magnitude larger or more than the scale height of the disk. So one qualitative way by which it could work, if you have a case where you have a thin target disk and a big cloud of the beam, okay, then the beam can mix a lot up here when it spends a lot of its time far away from the target. When it actually crosses the target is basically sampling an infinitesimal slice of the beam. So effectively, the density in this slice, the composition in this slice is effectively similar. So there can be easily, for instance, there is for sure or very likely a composition gradient for electrons and protons here, and a composition gradient for some sorts of nuclei compared to the others here in the halo. But the gas just samples a slice of this composition gradient. So where the fragmentation happens, effectively the composition is essentially homogeneous. But these are very rough qualitative pictures that we learn. And really, for me, what I can take from this result is a very simple qualitative fact. The density of antiprotons, if you relate it to the density of boron, they are just the ratio is just equal to the net production rate for antiprotons at boron locally. This is what we've learned, nothing else. It's a very qualitative lesson. It works, and that's what we know about propagation. So I'll spend, how much time do I have? Actually? 15, so I'll step up a little bit, but just a comment. There are, so what I've been doing so far is very simple generic relations. There are many quite detailed models for cosmic ray propagation in the galaxy. Problem has been under for many, many years, okay, tens of years. Models that are very popular now are homogeneous diffusion models. The good thing about these models is you can take them and calculate. The bad thing, as far as I know, you just don't know if they're correct. Because what you know reliably is just a simple qualitative relation that I said. So how are these models that people are using in the literature built? Often what they do, they assume the galaxy is effectively some box. So take this big cosmic halo that we've seen and simulate it with a box. Within the box, there is diffusion. So supposedly the particles diffuse, scatter on magnetic fields, irregularities and diffuse with a homogeneous diffusion coefficient k. It can be energy dependent. And the scale height of the box is fixed and independent of energy. And here is for you in a nutshell what these models are. Okay? Fixed box, independent of energy, zero boundary conditions outside. Inside diffusion, the production is by fragmentation. So this green here simulates the gas disk in the middle. So we know these models, there's 1 minute, the scale height of the gas disk is much, much smaller than the halo. Qualitatively, morphologically consistent with what we've just seen. We don't know if it's true that there is a box. We don't know if there are some well-defined vanishing boundary conditions. We don't know that there is universal, that there is homogeneous diffusion. Likely, this is not correct. But these are all, this is a fair ansatz of what's going on.
Before you said that diffusion doesn't depend on energy. When you were, you had a slide saying that diffusion doesn't depend
on energy. No, I never even assumed diffusion in what I do.
Well, you said propagation doesn't depend on. Well, what's the difference between propagation?
But it's not what I said. What the statement that I said, if you're referring to that, is that whatever propagation is, the trajectory of particles at the same rigidity are the same regardless of the species.
Yeah.
That's what I said.
Oh,
it doesn't mean
species,
there is definitely a rigidity dependence that we see. Yeah, very good. And but this requirement that I'm saying is fulfilled in these models because they have a diffusion coefficient that's only a function of rigidity. So the requirement A is fulfilled. Requirement B, homogeneous composition. The models take a thin disk. Often they're very elaborated, so there are many components. There can be some composition gradient in the disk. There will be some composition gradient in the cosmic ray in the hollow, but the basic structure of a very big hollow sampled with a very, very thin disk, effectively, we know this morphologically. So in all of these models, the composition where fragmentation happens is essentially constant, okay, in the problem, to a good approximation. So these are models that, these are, for instance, the class of models that are in tension with the positron measurement. And what you see here, so there were many papers in the literature using them, and this is results from a paper by these guys that is looking at the data from nuclei cosmic rays, like boron to carbon, sub-iron, et cetera. And this data, of course, constrain the model parameters, which are here the diffusion coefficient, energy dependence and normalization, and the size of the halo. And so this here is the size of this box in the model. This model has an infinitely thin disk, okay? And this here is the normalization of the diffusion coefficient. The shaded curves are curves of good chi-square, okay? Well, it's shaded, the chi-square is good. And you get different curves if you assume different energy dependence on the diffusion coefficient. Why am I going in for all of this? Because within this model, we think we have learned this very detailed restrictions on the model parameters, and we may accidentally think that we've actually measured the model parameters from the data. But that is not correct, because these models, by construction, satisfy the assumption that I've made. So the local densities are, again, just the ratios of these for secondaries are the ratios of knock-on-net sources. And this means that what these models do, they just calibrate x. The only object here that you learn is x. Once you've learned it for boron, it applies for everything else. So no information. Your chi-square can be infinitely good per degree of freedom because there are many measurements of antiprotons and of sub-iron elements. It can be very good because it's completely correlated. You've done it for boron. On general ground, you're going to succeed with the other secondaries, nuclei, where the data is good. For this model, I can go ahead and just calculate analytically what this x is. So L is the scale height. In that problem, they also took R as a parameter. R is the scale, is the radial scale. Take the model, calculate analytically what is the column density that you have. That's the expression, and these are the lines. What am I saying? I'm saying that these models fit the grammage. So these models are a very elaborate way to fit for X. That's what we've learned. X could come in any other way. The fact that you have an object like X here is because of the basic construction, which is good. It satisfies the basic criterion. But we don't learn anything about the details. That's an important point to take. OK. So I'll move on with a few minutes that I have to talk about the really interesting part. But now you understand all of the basics to interpret this measurement. So now we're going to the positrons. For the positrons, I can do a very similar analysis for antiprotons, OK? So let me imagine there is one big fundamental difference between electrons or positrons and protons and antiprotons. The difference is the mass is a factor of 1,000 lower, and so inverse Compton and synchrotron losses are very important, potentially, for electrons. So once you produce an electron and a proton, or an antiproton anywhere in the galaxy, they will propagate. But the energy of the electron will degrade with time, OK? How much energy you lose depends on how much time you spend in propagation. So the trajectories are no longer going to be the same. Okay? What I'm going to do here is a tiny leap of imagination and just imagine for a second that there are no energy losses. Okay? And calculate and do what you can do. All right? So, yeah.
I mean, if they are both relativistic, right?
Yes.
A proton and an electron.
Yes.
And if they have the same energy and the same charge, so why would the trajectory be?
So after a mega year in interstellar space, a 200 GeV electron will have of order a half of its initial energy. Or we don't know exactly because it depends on the magnetic field, all the details. But it will have less energy than it had when you produced it. The proton after a mega year will have exactly the same energies.
What's the difference?
So there is no reason. The trajectories. There is no reason to think that they were the same. So what I said before, Now, both relativistic, what I need the relativistic for is to neglect various adiabatic losses and, for instance, solar system modulations and some other effects. So when, let's put it this way. When the nuclei are not relativistic, there is a host of phenomena that can make the trajectory of an iron nucleus be different from the trajectory of a proton. When they're very relativistic, there is nothing, basically. But for electrons and protons, there is still this, the energy loss. So I produce at some point, I will produce this antiproton. It will go on some trajectory. And I produce an electron. And initially, it will go on the same trajectory. But then its Larmor radius is going to get smaller. And it could go wherever it wants.
What is the thing that makes a difference? There is nothing. I mean,
because I cannot use, there is no, let's put it this way. There is no reason to think that this grammage or column density formulation that I'm using will apply if you go and predict the flux of positrons. I gave a good reason to think it will apply for stable nuclei that don't change energy in propagation. That's what I said. If the particles change energy in propagation, then this average, and this x for these guys, for the stable guys, was just some average on all of the production volume of the propagation. But now the propagation of this electron, there's no reason to think that it will be the same as the propagation of the proton.
Maybe this is an inverse, because of inverse function.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
That's fine. Okay. That's what I was.
All right. Okay. So radiative losses. But so what can I do? I can write the same equation that I did. And if there were no energy losses, then I know exactly what to calculate, right? I can just repeat the antiproton application, all right? So this here is the same thing as I have for the antiprotons, just relevant for the positrons, which, for instance, x is linear for these guys. We can talk about that. But it's the same equation. What I'm doing is I'm just parameterizing my ignorance for the effect of energy losses by this quantity here that I call Fe plus. This will parameterize the amount of energy losses, okay? If there were no losses at all, or in other words, if the cooling time, if the rate of change of the yellow trajectory compared to the change, compared to the total time of the of an average trajectory, so if the rate with which the yellow trajectory differs from the white is much, much smaller than the time scale for a complete trajectory, then I should be in the regime where F is equal to 1. Okay? Because then trajectories are the same to good accuracy, and I can do this exercise, and F should be 1, and I have a robust prediction. If the yellow trajectories differ from the white ones on time scales shorter than the average total propagation time, then I will be measuring F from the data. And there is something very simple I can say about this F. So I have little time, but not a completely trivial point, but this F is smaller than 1. Should better be smaller than 1. Why is it not completely trivial? If you imagine some spectrum of electrons injected to the interstellar matter, then you propagate it. Energy cooling, so energy losses, what do energy losses do? If I have some spectrum, then energy losses will take a particle produced at some high energy and plug it back at a lower energy. Okay, you didn't kill this particle, you just took some energy off it. Now, if the spectrum is shallow, a process like that, in principle, could lead to a bump or a pileup in the propagated spectrum. If you could have a pileup, then this F could have been larger than 1. Okay? At some points in energy, you could have an increase because of pileup. So I'm just making the simple comment that with Compton losses and with the measured steep spectrum, for Compton losses, if the initial injected spectrum is steeper than 2, index of 2, then there is no pileup. So just this comment, you can prove it easily with a piece of paper. So just from this observed spectrum and what we know about Compton losses, this F should be smaller than 1. Okay, and what it is exactly, I can if you give me a model, I can calculate it, all right? And it differs between different models. So the only robust statements I can say is, I had this previously for antiprotons with an equality. For positrons, I have a lower than, okay? And that's the data. So by me, what we're measuring, this data is never in any significant way larger than this prediction, okay, the secondary prediction. So what this data really is a measurement of the amount of loss of the size of F this positron experience. It didn't need to be this way. So if Pamela would go up above this region, or if you would see a very, very sharp feature, as can happen in some of these pulsar or dark matter models, that would be a very strong hint against this production mechanism. Okay? But wherever it's measured, in all of this range, the data that you measure is here between a factor of 3 below the upper bound to roughly within the upper bound. And still there is room to a factor of 2 or at least 50% suppression here by the calculation uncertainties. Okay? So it's perfectly consistent with secondary, with just the process that we understand. And this F is smaller than 1. So it's really a measurement of F. So I have little time. Let me just wrap up. And there is a lot more. I'm happy to discuss more on this. So first, why is it so urgent in the literature, I think, to stress that, that there must be primary source? And the statement that I disagree with. So claims of a primary source, there are basically two lines of reasoning that you find where people actually give an argument why they think it's primary. There are two lines of reasoning. The first line of reasoning says, let's imagine that the electrons that we're seeing, so we've all we did by now was positrons. But let's think about electrons for a second. So let's imagine that the electrons, electron spectrum that we're seeing is coming from exactly the same accelerator as a proton spectrum. And moreover, assume that they're injected, electrons and protons are injected with the same power law index at the source. Okay? If you imagine that, and you make another assumption, the another assumption that you make is after the injection with the same spectrum, electrons and positrons suffer the same energy losses. If you make this assumption, then this positron function, the Pamela measure these positrons to electrons effectively, and the positrons are coming from proton fragmentation on ISM, we know that there is this X factor there that is measured to go down like e to the minus 0.5. And so, and the electron downstairs, by assumption, have the same spectrum as the proton. So before energy losses, you would expect a fraction that goes like e to the minus 0.5, so a decreasing fraction. And now this there is another assumption here that the losses are the same. So the numerator and denominator degrade equally under propagation. Then you get a contradiction with what is measured. But it's very simple. We don't know that the electrons are injected like the protons. If you check in existing models, the indexes of the initial spectra are free parameters. It's not known on first principles, and there is no reason to think. Exactly because of energy losses, electrons could easily lose energy during the Fermi acceleration and can be ejected with a much softer spectrum than the protons. The point is we just don't know. Okay? And we don't know that the energy losses are the same. So of course, if you give me a positron and an electron at 100 GeV, from that point, they will lose the same amount of energy. But electrons still need to go some distance from whatever their source is to where the positrons are produced. And there, they could lose another fraction of energy that could be energy dependent by itself. In other words, just not known. The other line of reasoning, you see many papers just quote a propagation model. I discussed these propagation models before. You can show that within this box, constant box diffusion, homogeneous diffusion, there should be this positron ratio should be decreasing. Okay? So these models are excluded by the data, or if you want, they're inconsistent with the data. But the bottom line is that we just don't know what the propagation is. There are many assumptions that are going in there. The galaxy is probably not a box. No reason to think that the boundary is energy independent and whatever. So we don't have much time. But I think, again, this fact that that primary sources, what we're seeing here, that's just the data, we're seeing a measurement that is broadly within the scale of what you can calculate reliably to a factor of 3. If you add a pulsar model or some dark matter model, there is no reason in the world why you should end up with a positron flux in this ballpark. It's a scale that doesn't exist in those models. And if you look at models in the literature, that's exactly what is happening. So overproducing these positrons easily. Now, not all of them will overproduce the positrons. And each and every one of them, you can downscale if you want, just because the model doesn't tell you anything about the scale. These are free parameters. So the fact that you're sitting And that's interpretation-free fact. The fact that your flux is completely consistent with the secondary calculation, again, just calculate and compare, that would be a puzzle for these interpretations, the way I see it. Again, doesn't exclude it, but there is no reason. And if you look at the works that are out there, this scale doesn't exist automatically in the problem. And it's exactly the same thing for pulsars that can give you basically what you want them to give you. So this is the calculation from loop one, the contribution from loop one, supposedly, and that's the Pamela data. AMS is now here, and I guarantee to you that loop one is still there on the sky. There is no problem. Simple fact is we don't know how to calculate the contribution of this loop one thing. It could have been there. It could be there. It could kick in at some point. But it would be a puzzle why the flux we see sits max in the calculation right now. And the case for a secondary source, and I'm not going to go into details, so to be very clear, the fact that the suppression with the energy, so the gap between this upper bound and the measurement, the fact that this gap is decreasing with energy is counterintuitive and surprising somewhat. It's not naively expected theoretically. And that's from the properties of Compton cooling and from the energy dependence of X, of the Coulomb density. And I'm happy to discuss this much more. It's a puzzle, and it's very worthy of exploring. And there are ways to address it within a secondary propagation model, but it's very interesting and possibly testable. And I think the summary for the secondary case is just this. Throughout the scale where we have a measurement and reasonable theoretical control, the measurement is to a factor of 3 within this prediction, okay? Everywhere, from here all the way up. And there are no free parameters in that. It's completely consistent with the antiproton, so we know what we're doing at least roughly or within these uncertainties for the cross sections, et cetera, and the grammage. There is no non-contradiction, nothing that I know of with experimental data. There is a big contradiction with theoretical assumptions that are out there, okay? But nothing with actual experimental data. And this is a prediction from 2009 that we didn't touch, okay? So I don't have time to go in more detail, just in a nutshell. One way you can try to go after to check the consistency of this with other data is to look at radioactive nuclei. So just to highlight basically the heart of the problem with using something like bone to carbon and antiprotons to try to constrain the positrons is just this fact. The only thing that the bone and the antiproton measure is the Coulomb density. Okay, so if you have some beam of carbon that's going through a molecular cloud with some density, okay, the amount of boron that you're going to get in the end doesn't care the least of how long it took for this carbon to traverse the cloud. All it cares about is the total Coulomb density. So it can be, it could take a kilo year propagation time in a very dense molecular cloud, for instance, where an electron along this beam wouldn't lose even a bit of energy in the ISM. Or it could take a mega year if it's a very rarefied ISM. An electron would lose a lot. But the bone to carbon wouldn't care the least, or the antiprotons, about how much time it took to traverse this Coulomb density. So these are very completely separate problems in principle. One thing that does get information is radioactive nuclei, like beryllium-10, that you produce them. They have this cute property. You produce them. They live for a mega year and decay. Okay. And so this is somewhat similar to the case with the positrons that you produce them. They live for a while, and they lose energy, and you lose them. Okay? So you can learn something from the radioactives. Skipping the details, it's not completely trivial to understand why you can even compare a radioactive nuclei to an electron. But you can. Up to logarithmic correction, you understand the comparison. We can go back to this if you want. And there is a sweet spot. So what I'm plotting here, the lines, here is rigidity, so energy divided by charge, and here is time. And these lines are the observer frame lifetime for several radioactive nuclei. And the observer frame lifetime go up like the boost factor. Okay? So if I measure them at different energy, I explore different lifetimes. That's cute. And here is a rough estimate of the electron cooling time if I use the radiation field that I measure locally. Okay? And the cooling time of electron goes down with energy. The lifetime of a radioactive radioisotope goes up with the boost factor. There will be a sweet spot. There will be some energy range. Well, these lifetimes will be comparable, potentially. So the cooling time that I can estimate will be roughly comparable with the observer from lifetime of some radioisotope. That sweet spot happens for beryllium-10, which is the best measured one. That's the blue curve, at rigidity of about 20 gigavolts. So we analyzed this. There is an analysis, not using almost any propagation analysis that I know, that actually looked at the losses for the beryllium at these energies, up to roughly these energies. So what we're talking about is the measurement here of the beryllium losses, that I'm not going to explain exactly. But you measure a suppression because of the decay. And this is the corresponding measurement for the electrons. And these are the numbers that you get where these guys roughly meet. And this is perfectly consistent. So where we can say something more or less direct, this gap here is perfectly understood within a secondary production. And you can go and do more details. So we have many of these radioactive elements. I did this in 2010. And you can try to understand the energy dependence of the propagation time from that. But we're not there yet to put a robust test for the positrons. AMS, these are measurements from the 80s. AMS will do this much better. Okay? If we can separate, the moment we can separate between fit like that for this function, this is the suppression factor because of decay, from this fit to these fit, then we're in the ballpark, okay, to put a direct limit on what we're saying for the positrons. And this could work, and this could exclude the secondary picture, even if this F is smaller than 1. Okay? So even if you don't cross the line just from the energy dependence, it's more difficult, but you can, in principle, exclude the secondary picture. But you need better data in this, and it's not a trivial thing. So let me summarize. I think it's clear that the AMS results are in support of secondary origin for the positrons. It's not free of puzzles, but just remember the main picture. This cosmic ray problem is full of puzzles. We don't know where they're coming from in the first place. Okay, we don't know how the propagation works. It's a miracle that we can even say something about these secondaries, but it turns out that we can. It's consistent with the prediction that was made in 2009. I don't see any need right now for a primary source, and I would think it's somewhat surprising. So it's what I'm saying is, of course, preliminary. If this data goes up, it's the end of the secondary story. Okay, that would be very exciting. But if this data continues to be consistent with the secondary calculation that we will be able to do with the AMS, then I think just the coincidence of scales underscores primary sources that know nothing about this scale. Of course, you can put here whatever you want. You can always assume that there is a lot of there are big losses. We don't know that, and add a primary source. But you will need to answer the question why your primary source exactly saturates what we see from the ISM collisions. Okay? There are good questions for cosmic ray physics. We may be seeing propagation time that has a non-trivial energy dependence, and it's possible that the escape time is smaller than a mega year. So I can discuss in astrophysics. I'm happy to discuss this further with anybody. And all of this will be tested better with AMS-2. So they claim eventually they'll go to the TeV range. So we can really test this thing. We'll see where we are, and we can calculate here. And we can also do this with using radioisotope data and understand what's going on. All right, thanks.
So, I mean, what you have here is not really a prediction. As you said, it's an upper limit.
Yes.
I don't know if you can call it a prediction. But
well, I can call it a prediction, of course, because look at this. It is an upper limit. It's limited prediction. Right. But when you look at this PAMELA data, there was no reason to imagine from the data this thing is going to saturate.
There is no way to model this F, whatever you call it.
Not directly from the stable nucleus.
But the fact is that in all these propagation models, there is a way to determine this, and that's due to this inverse compton or synchrotron losses.
It's not the point. It's not the inverse compton. The main point is these models have a prediction. So how are these models built? They are tuned to give boron to carbon, as I showed you, all of them, and are consistent in this case. Mm-hmm. But within the model, when you fix the coulomb density, you also fix the propagation time in a given way. When you fix the propagation time goes down like e to the minus half. When you do that, you find yourself in tension with this. But that's a very detailed model prediction. There is nothing in the boron-to-carbon data itself to tell you that the propagation time scale in a similar way to the coulomb density. And it doesn't need to do that. I hope I'm answering your question. So these models, in fact, so right. So they have. You can calculate within these models. You can calculate this F, and they're wrong.
So the fact is that the chance of the proton getting to us from a large distance is much more like much higher than an electron reaching us, because electrons lose their energy very, very quickly.
Okay. So now, very good. So now your question is exactly this astrophysics. The rate at which an electron loses energy is roughly understood to within a factor of a few. Okay? What is completely not understood, as I'm claiming, is the time scale of propagation. So quantitatively, your question is the following. And I can tell you that about 200, 300 GeV, the cooling time scale is of order a mega year, not much more than this. Maybe 2 mega year, not more. So quantitatively, what this measurement tells me for secondary interpretation is that the propagation time scale is below a mega year at 300 GeV. Okay? I'm saying that the time of an average orbit is shorter than a mega year at this energy. And the question is there any piece of data that contradicts this statement?
Okay? The measurements of the diffusion, so I guess the claim is that when you fit these detailed abundances, you fit for the diffusion.
Yes.
And you're saying you don't believe that.
What I'm saying is that I don't see in the data a reason to believe that. Whether I believe it or not, we can talk about it offline. But in the data I just showed you, there is no reason right now to believe that the scaling is correct. Now, there is a lot to do. You can look at the gamma rays. You can look at the radiation, photons, etc. So gamma ray, radio, whatever, try to understand how this halo, if the halo is changing with energy or where the cosmic ray is coming.
My feeling is that, okay, you say there are large uncertainties. So the onus is on you to come up with an alternative model which actually can give the data that you're saying. Just saying that we don't have an exact model of the galaxy, so we cannot say anything. I would say that may not be very convincing. I think what's more convincing is that, okay, you say those models are not very good, they are too rough. Okay, so this is an alternative model that
No, what I said. What I said is the following. I said you have cosmic ray data. You want to understand propagation. I don't understand propagation, right? And I don't have an answer for this. I have some models, sure, and we can talk offline for the, within secondary production. But I don't know what is the difference of propagation. But I have a database of cosmic rays, and I want to build models for that. And there are a list of constraints, experimental constraints, for model building. One is the boron-to-carbon, which is the generator, as we said, with antiprotons and sub-iron. Another is radioactive elements, and yet another is positrons. Within these constraints, we should find a model that satisfies all of them. Before the positron measurement, these diffusion models satisfied the constraints that we had.
Yeah.
Now we have a new constraint. They don't satisfy all the constraints anymore.
We should think of another model. Okay. But you don't have the toy model.
So the very simplest toy model you can think of is, what if the scale size, so imagine homogeneous diffusion, everything is cool, everybody's happy. And but the scale size of the propagation region is a function, depends on rigidity. So solve the diffusion problem, but now imagine that higher energy particles, when they reach a smaller scale height above the disk, they're free to go. And lower energy particles can roam higher up. If you check the scaling of the propagation time compared to the scaling of the coulomb density, will change. And if the halo shrinks fast enough with energy, and fast enough is this, okay? What I did here is exactly fast enough. If the halo shrinks fast enough, everybody's happy, okay? So that's the very simplest thing. If I think it's very likely, not more than homogeneous diffusion in the first place, but it can be tested eventually. So there are many ways you can try. We can talk about physically what it means in these models that the halo shrinks.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes that up. Since the diffusion depends on energy, then the size could also depend on energy.
Yeah. So we can talk that the diffusion is determined in these models, or supposedly come in these models from pitch angle scattering. So you have a particle in some spiraling, and the particle can change directions by scattering on magnetic field turbulence. If there are no turbulence and the particle at given Larmor radius scatters preferentially on turbulence on the size characteristic scale of the Larmor radius. All right? So if you lose turbulence and high energy is larger on Larmor radius, imagine there is a cutoff to the turbulence spectrum in the ISM, and the place where the cutoff happens in scale size. You just don't have very large scale turbulence far off the disk. Then you will have this effectively. So just one way.
All right, we're quite a bit over, so let's all thank you again.